Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. Last week, an independent report by Adam Tolley Casey, looking at whether Dominic Raab bullied civil servants, led to the now former Deputy Prime Minister resigning. In my clinical work, whether it's listening to couples teetering on the edge of divorce or someone on sick leave due to a toxic work environment, it is clear that bullying occupies a rather grey area where one person's exacting standards or jokes are another person's intimidation or contempt or coercive control. And just as some marriages are toxic, so some work environments can be too. To help me unpick whether bullying is systemic at Westminster and what to do about it, I'm delighted to welcome back to my couch Peter Cardwell, political editor of Talk TV, special advisor to four cabinet ministers, and author of the book The Secret Life of Special Advisors. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Lucy. Lovely to be back with you.
Really good to have you back on my couch. I obviously didn't bully you enough. Maybe I've bullied you onto my couch this
time. No, this is entirely voluntary, or so you told me to say.
Checks in the post. Given how bullying can be quite hard to identify, as I've said there, that one person's bullying is just another person's high demanding standards. What did you think when you first heard, firstly, about the Dominic Raab allegations and more recently, Steve Barclay's alleged conduct towards civil servants? What did you think was really going on?
Well, there's a very weird Venn diagram between what the civil service wants and expects, and both the working practices and the standards that the civil service acts within, and the framework really, and also the law in terms of how the civil service works from an HR perspective. And then you have this very, very weird thing at the very top, which are these ministers, these elected politicians who are selected by the Prime Minister to fulfil ministerial roles. Now, they will often not have been for perhaps a long time, perhaps they've been an MP for 10 years or something like that, have been within a sort of formal working structure in the same way as civil servants will have been. Politicians by themselves are fascinating characters, and often I'm sure they would give you a lot to chew on as a psychotherapist in terms of just their behaviours in general. And of course, we've talked about that before, Lucy. But in terms of Dominic Raab and Steve Barclay, I know a little bit, not really. Dominic Raab, I know relatively well. I worked with him. He was the housing minister when I was in the ministry, what was then called the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. Now, I didn't work for him directly as a special advisor. I worked for the then Secretary of State, a man called James Brokenshire. But Dominic was one of our junior ministers. I knew him. I worked with him. And I knew that he had quite a reputation for being quite exacting, quite a serious person, probably not someone you're going to go to the pub with at the end of the week to kick back and have a pint with, but nonetheless, someone who was quite an effective minister. Now, I didn't see him bully anybody, but when these allegations came out saying that he was a difficult character, I could see kind of where that had come from, whilst at the same time, not to my knowledge anyway, and not in my experience, having seen him bully anyone previously, but I knew as there were different ministers, and there was a very interesting department. You had Jake Berry there as well, who went on to be chairman of the Conservative Party, Kit Malthouse, who went on to be a cabinet minister, and also a young whippersnapper in the office two doors down from Dominic Raab called Rishi Sunak. Whatever happened to him, he was the local government minister. So there were a lot of people with a lot of potential trying to climb the greasy pole. And the back round to that really was the civil service and people who, of course, themselves act in a political way. It may not be politics with a big P, but it's definitely politics with a small P. And of course, their jobs are secure. They're probably there until retirement and have a good pension as a result, and there's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, the politicians, well, their jobs might end within any moment for any number of reasons. Maybe it'll be their fault, maybe it's not.
I think that insecurity does mean that you haven't got the same power on both sides. It might look like the minister has all the power and the civil servants are just doing their bidding, but actually, as you say, their very circumstances of their working contract means that they've got a tenure that they that perhaps can make them feel more comfortable and maybe more agile when it comes to playing the small p politics of office life, because that's what happens in all workplaces. There's a kindergarten dimension to it, where everyone is having to relearn all of those basics about relationships, but ultimately also how to get out on top. That's human, I suppose, in a very Freudian way, that's what humans are always trying to do. They're trying to compete with the other person. So do you think that what we're seeing is a power battle rather than an individual personality clash? Because the report by Adam Tolley did actually highlight the fact that he didn't think Dominic Raab, for example, had personalized very much of this interaction, what was described as bullying. That do you think it's fundamental to the relationship between ministers and the civil service that there will always be this tension?
There will always be a tension. Of course, nobody thinks they are a bully. Everyone who's a bully thinks that they're being totally reasonable. And in terms of this tension, it absolutely is there. In terms of the tenure, in terms of the power, it is a very, very interesting thing. And also, you don't really know who to trust. It's not a normal working relationship. It's not as if you're coming in. It can be tricky to come in as a manager of new people anyway. But if you know, and everybody knows, that you're probably only going to be there for 18 months to 2 years maximum before there's a reshuffle, who do you trust? How do you put your stamp there? How do you know that the person who's coming to you saying being really nice to you, are they being nice because they're really nice? Or are they being nice because they want to ingratiate themselves with you to bolster their own position as a civil servant? I absolutely had that myself to someone when I arrived in a department, a very senior person, who was all over me like a rash. I'm so glad you're here, someone with your expertise and background and experience. How wonderful, we're going to all work together. Within weeks, that person was briefing against me to journalists, was trying to get me removed from my position at various points. And also, actually, in that same example, it would be unfair to say which department it was in, but there was another figure, senior figure, at roughly the same level, who I was told by someone who'd been there slightly longer than me, well, this guy's quite political with the small p. He really wants to climb the greasy pole. Just watch him. You know, he's a bit dodgy. Turns out the second guy was just a bit quiet, just a bit of an introvert, just someone who didn't feel that actually his job was to ingratiate himself. He felt his job was to get on, do his job well, and serve the public as a very decent civil servant. Who's the one who is still my friend and still I ask for advice? Often the second guy, because sometimes in any workplace, but certainly in the civil service, sometimes the people who are the quietest and don't feel they need to push themselves forward are actually the ones who really know what's going on and actually know what can be achieved for a minister or even a special advisor in terms of what they want to achieve. And actually it's very good to ask for advice in terms of how things really work, not how they seem to work or how often senior civil servants want to present how things work within the civil service, which will be to their benefit and say, oh, we've done this amazing thing. We've got an incredible victory. Look at me. I'm wonderful. Will you be my friend, Secretary of State? And then it's on to the next one as soon as that Secretary of State or minister gets moved.
Well, it's fascinating that you should talk about that different personality style, really, because I was with one of my former bosses last week. So obviously we got on well because we still see each other. And we were at the memorial service for someone who had actually led the bank that we worked for. And in the eulogy, it was mentioned that he had been the kind of man who would, if he needed to tick you off, he would do so mildly that it would possibly take you about 2 hours to work out that you had actually been reprimanded by him. But everyone loved him. Everyone adored working for him. And as a result, they always stepped up to the plate to almost try to please him. This was the parent they wanted the approval of, if you like. Do you think work in Westminster would ever get done if that was the approach that more ministers took? In other words, is it the nature of Westminster and the nature of the decisions that need to be made that people actually need to be more brutal?
I think they need to be really clear about what they want, and they need to follow that up as well, because there is this idea within the civil service. I don't blame the civil service for this, that it is the permanent civil service. If Labour come in 2024, they've all suddenly got to work for Labour government and do things totally differently. So I remember being in a meeting with quite a senior civil servant who said, look, if you implement this policy, you will have serious financial problems for the department in 5 years' time. And I said, well, we want this policy. Prime Minister wants this policy, and I don't care about 5 years' time because Labour will probably be in government anyway and they can deal with it. But that civil servant may well be in the same job in 5 years' time and he might have to deal with it. So that in itself is a very small example of something which is the tension, the difference. To get things through, sometimes you do need to have very tough conversations. Sometimes you need to be very clear, but there are ways to do that. There are ways to, like you talked about your boss, there are ways to get things done in a different way. And actually the best example of any boss I've ever worked with was that person I mentioned earlier, James Brokenshire. And what he did, he was quite a tough person. The people who worked with him worked really hard for him, but they worked hard for him because they respected him. And what happened with me, sometimes, look, I was very tough with some civil servants. Sometimes I raised my voice to civil servants. Sometimes I did some things I'm probably not that proud of in terms of how I dealt with civil servants occasionally. And I think when you have some power or at least influence, that can sometimes go to your head. And certainly at the end of my 3.5 years as a special advisor, I was a much better and much more effective special advisor than I was at the start. And I think as I moved through the 4 different departments I worked in, I became better because I knew what to do. I knew how the system worked and I knew myself better as well. But with James, for example, he was very good at getting things done. He had a very, very clear vision. He knew the steps that needed to be done, and he was realistic about the fact that he was probably going to only be in the job for between 18 months to 2 years. And actually, I remember Liam Booth-Smith, who was one of his other special advisors who I worked with, who's now the chief of staff to Rishi Sunak at 10 Downing Street, so a very successful special advisor, said, we've got to get down on one piece of paper, one A4 side of paper, send it out to every single person in the department and say, these are our ministerial priorities. This is what we want to do. Let's be totally clear. And if something's a priority, other things aren't a priority. And there's an idea, and that can have a psychological effect on people as well. What I always said when people came to work with James or anybody who was working in what's called private office, which is the group of usually about 10 to 15 people who sort of run the Secretary of State's life and communicate with the rest of department, where you're often dealing with thousands of other people, the sort of Praetorian guard around a minister.
Yeah.
I said, if someone started to work in private office, often very talented people, I would say, if I'm ever tough on you, it's because the standards expected from James of me and all of us are so incredibly high. And I knew that I had to work really, really hard to reach his standards, but he didn't really need to say anything. It was just clear what the standards were. And if you fell below those standards, you certainly knew about it, but it was kind of like the parent you love. I remember I did fall below the standards one time in one of my behaviors, and James just said, that's really disappointing. I mean, it was the worst. You know, you could have shouted and screamed at me and, you know, gone histrionics and all the rest of it. But actually, it was really, I felt awful for days afterwards. Also, what I used to say to the people who worked in private office, I said, look, if James ever says, this is ridiculous, that's when you know you're in serious, serious trouble. And about once every few weeks, James would just say, would be told, oh, well, we've asked another department, or we've asked number 10, or we've asked officials to do this. This hasn't happened. We're way behind schedule. Da, da, da. And he'd just go in a totally normal, clear, quiet voice, well, this is ridiculous. And then we would all go, oh no, we've all got to redouble our efforts. We've got to run away. We've got to do everything. And that is so incredibly effective, because it's the person who swears every second word and you don't notice them swearing. And then it's your granny who says the F word and you go, oh, granny said the F word. You know, it's that kind of thing.
And I think that speaks also to a couple of other words that you've used already, which is trust and respect, that actually when you have that in a relationship, all sorts of other things are smoothed, aren't they? Because there is that clear belief that I'm doing this for somebody I admire, I respect, I trust them. The trust goes both ways. It's a very reciprocated relationship. And again, that gets replicated in, you know, romantic relationships, family relationships. There seems to be a problem when those two fundamentals of trust and respect don't exist, then there's a free-for-all. Then there really is the opportunity for one side, let's say the civil servants, to say, oh, well, I think I'm being bullied here. I'm being talked to in a way that isn't effective. This relationship is dysfunctional. Whereas really what they're saying is there hadn't been that respect. There hadn't been trust.
Well, I was in a situation yesterday. Newsrooms are actually fairly similar newsrooms can often be similar to politics. And I was in a situation in one newsroom a while ago where one person, I was in what's called the gallery, the control room, and I was having a conversation with someone. And the producer who was involved with putting out the program that I was involved with said, guys, I'm really under the pressure here. You couldn't just go outside and have that conversation. And he said it in a perfectly respectful, normal way. But the person I was having a conversation with who had to go out said, how dare he speak to us in that way? That was so rude. That was incredibly rude. And I thought, well, no, it wasn't. It was perfectly reasonable thing to say in the circumstances. And the interpretation of so many instructions, people, and also your experience. There's one journalist I worked with who was a totally bully, horrendous, dreadful person. But because I had worked earlier in my career, when I was in my 20s, with another broadcaster who was much, much worse than the person I've just mentioned, well, I can kind of contextualize that and see it in a very, very different way and realize that the original person I was mentioning actually is bad, but not as bad as the other one. And if that's your only experience, if you're a young person, young civil servant, for example, working for a minister who shouts and screams, or even is just very tough on you, you might think, well, that's unreasonable, when actually in the context that you're, hate the phrase, but lived experience, that is something very, very different.
That's right. I remember working with somebody when I was working at a particular mental hospital where somebody had come in for complete burnout, triggered by a big work crisis, a big personality clash. But actually, what was really at root of this person's lived experience was a very dysfunctional relationship with their parent. And so same-sex parent, and also the colleague was the same sex as this patient. And what was happening in the workplace was reactivating a lot of the drama and the crises from childhood. So it wasn't actually the work and the personality clash itself that was really doing the damage. It was some unresolved stuff from the past. But what I observed about that was the way in which you could tell that it wasn't really about the relationship, because the personality clash began on day one. So there wasn't any sense of, well, let's give the benefit of the doubt. Let's see what this person is like. Let's get to know you. And I have sometimes wondered whether some of these accusations of bullying are less about the actual relationship between the two individuals and more about a bigger thing, maybe a way in which a relationship is a trigger for something earlier, or it's a stand-in, and this is what some people are raising concerns about. Is there some sense in which civil servants are uncomfortable about some of the things that they're asked to work on, even though political neutrality is the core of their contract, so to speak? But is it possible that there are other things that are being mobilized beyond the simple interaction between two individuals? Surely that must happen quite a lot in Westminster.
Yes, it does. And I think that the impartiality thing is fascinating, because no one is truly impartial. Everybody has political views. Everybody has ideas on all sorts of things and the things that they're working on. The good thing about the civil service is that it's so big, and it's such a big thing as an employer that you can actually move. I mean, if you really are a kind of, you know, tree hugging, let's bring in all the migrants, let's ship them all over on cruise liners and put them up in massively expensive accommodation and free food for life. Well, probably don't go and work for the Home Office. You know, that's probably not going to be where you're going to have a happy and successful career. So these things can be quite clear, I think. but on a lot more of, I think in terms of working with ministers, that is, it's generally quite clear what the role is. And if you don't like the role, there are lots of other ways you can move within the civil service. And people do, I think a lot of people don't realize that most people in the civil service spend a year to 18 months in their jobs and then move on, certainly at the lower levels. And there is often a lack of expertise within the civil service, even though people think, well, it's the permanent civil service, there are lots of people who know lots of things about subject areas. There can be, but certainly, yes, you're right. It is sometimes more about what's being asked of them. London, for example, is a Remainer city. Most people voted Remain, and by its very nature, the civil service, because it's full of middle-class people who live in London, will have a lot of Remainers in it. Now, if you're being asked to implement Brexit, you may say, well, look, democratic vote, that's my job, I'm going to do it. And also, it's not as if Brexit, for example, was one discrete policy. It came into so many different areas. So what I was saying about the Home Office a minute ago, don't work in the Home Office, fair enough, I'll go work in the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and I'll work in the Soil Directorate there. Instead of that, I will, it's tough to kind of escape Brexit, actually, because it deals in with all sorts of different departments. And because it was such a huge policy, permeating so many different departments, I think that was something that was bound to face resistance in some ways, because it's such a divisive issue in the country, because the vote was so close, because so many Remainers have a very, very strong opinion on it, the sort of Remainer versus Remainer kind of argument. Well, obviously, that was going to be a big culture clash in many regards. And also, the civil service is mostly about continuity and not change, whereas Brexit was such a huge change. So I think that's a very good example of something where the policy was something that the civil service didn't necessarily rail against. I think some of them did, absolutely. But it was almost an unexpected thing to be asked to do. Whereas if you look back to, you know, the difference between what John Major's government did and what Tony Blair's government did was fundamentally different in many ways, but not that different. You're dealing with a sort of centre-right government versus a centre-left government. Civil service aren't doing things that are generally kind of-ish the same. Whereas Brexit, for example, totally different, unexpected, vote didn't go the way a lot of people thought was going to go, massively permeating of all sorts of different departments. Therefore, you get some form of resistance. And I think that whilst the civil service shouldn't have resisted, it should have done absolutely what it was told, democratic mandate was there. At the same time, you can see on there are lots of small ways where things like that can be frustrated. And for someone like Dominic Raab, for example, massive Brexiteer, perhaps that frustrated him in many ways. Perhaps that put into his mind that the civil service was against him, and perhaps some of his behaviour cannot be excused, but explained through that.
Well, finally, because we've just had the resignation of Raab, and we've now got new revelations potentially about Steve and Barclay's alleged conduct, things are very brittle at the moment. That relationship between civil servants and ministers is clearly under the microscope. What do you think needs to be done quickly to restore trust?
I think it's a far bigger thing than anything that could be done quickly. I think that over the past, especially the past, I would say, since Brexit, I think the relationship between the civil service and the ministers has been very problematic. I think that, you know, there have been literally hundreds of ministers in both Conservative and Liberal Democrats since 2010. And it's only really in the last few years that we've had these bullying allegations. Is that linked? Is that linked to Brexit? Is that linked to the culture of the civil service? Is that linked to how things have tried to change? Is that linked to Dominic Cummings and his changes in the civil servants service and changes in civil servants in terms of people, permanent secretaries, for example, who were removed? Liz Truss removed Tom Scholar at the Treasury, for example. That was something that really upset a lot of people. It was a really stupid thing to do, like basically everything else she did as Prime Minister and Kwasi Kwarteng. And essentially, it was something that destabilised things and said the continuity wasn't there. The not cosiness, but nonetheless predictability of the civil service for people who join maybe out of university and expect to be in the same organisation, possibly for 40 years, well, that changed the whole definition and nature of things. And there has been a lot of change in that relationship. So to restore trust, we'll see. Maybe Labour, if they come in after 2024, things will be different. But I think often, I'm not sure what, once you've broken something, whether it can be really, really be fixed in this regard anyway.
Peter Cardwell, political editor of Talk TV, but also author of a brilliant book, which we've heard a little bit about on this podcast, The Secret Life of Special Advisors, which has made you such a perfect guest to talk to me today on The Couch. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Lucy.